If you're an individual or business looking to create stellar video or audio content, check out Black Bear Media. You can find us at www.blackbearmedia.net, or you can write us at info@blackbearmedia.net. You're listening to More Than This, the podcast where Christian faith and reason explore reasons for Christian faith. Life is not a sequence programmed from the sky, but it's a story woven up, down, in and out, like the stitches in a... If you enjoy our show, please consider supporting us for as little as $1 a month on Patreon. Check out our site at www.patreon.com/morethanthispod. Thank you. This week, we talked to Rob Brenneman and Brian Miller about their book, Building Faith, A Sociology of Religious Structures. We talk about the role of physical buildings in building and sustaining communities of faith. Enjoy. Welcome to More Than This. I'm excited for today's conversation. We have a kind of a follow-up to, we spoke with a woman named Anna Wolfenden a few weeks ago about kind of a theology of place. And this is kind of an extension, a different take on that conversation. I have a couple of my former Notre Dame colleagues in the house today. So the college connections run thick. I have Robert Brenneman and Brian Miller with us today. They have a new book out. We're going to hear about. It's all about the interaction of sacred buildings and communities of faith. So just jump right in. I want to hear from the guys a little bit. Bob, if you could jump in and just tell us a little bit about what you're up to now and introduce yourself. We'd love to get a little bit of background on you.
Yeah, I am. My name's Rob Brenneman. I'm kind of shifting from Bob to Rob, but go ahead and stick with Bob if that's what you're used to, because I'm fine with that. For the last 10 years, I've been at St. Michael's College, which is a small liberal arts college, Catholic liberal arts college in just outside of Burlington, Vermont. Had a very good experience there, good colleagues, great students, enjoyed myself, but my wife and I started feeling the pull to be closer to family as our kids got a little bit older. And so we just a couple of months ago made the transition to Goshen College, which is a historic Mennonite college here in northern Indiana, and a place where I have a lot of connections, family and faith connections and friends and so on.
So Rob, we got to know each other a long time ago. Brian, Rob, and I all went to Notre Dame. And we're students in sociology there. So that's their background as well. Obviously, I've gone on and gotten my PhD in counseling, but still have a lot of sociological imagination and curiosity. So I was excited to talk about their new book today. Brian and Brooke know each other from undergrad. And Brian, you've done a very successful boomerang in your career. So tell us a little bit about where you are now and what you're up to.
Good to be with you today. I've been at Wheaton College now. This will be year number 12 teaching sociology. Brooke and I were classmates back in the early 2000s, and then I was off to graduate school at Notre Dame and then back to Wheaton. And to preview a little bit of where this book came from, when Bob came up with the idea, this hit me at a time when I was thinking a little bit more earlier in my career about how do you combine religion and place. It takes sort of two areas that I'm interested in, urban sociology and sociology of culture, and kind of puts them together in some physical space or setting. And our book takes that up with buildings. And so we went from there.
And tell us the title.
Building Faith, A Sociology of Religious Structures.
Strong title.
I love it. And if anybody out there is a little averse to numbers, this is not that kind of sociology book. It is not just chock full of stats and T and P and all kinds of other values. It's not super table heavy in that regard, is it, fellas? You would say somebody could get by just fine. It's a little more narrative based. What's that?
It has pictures.
It does. It has pictures. Boy, the older I get, the more I appreciate a good photo filler in a book and something to look at to kind of break up the field when I'm reading. I'd love to hear from each of you kind of what drew you to the project. Rob, I'll start with you just because I know that Brian just hinted that this was the impetus for this book was probably yours. So, Rob, what kind of led you to this project?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say there was kind of a gradual process, and there was also kind of a moment that was important. The gradual process is that starting in graduate school, I started paying more and more attention to buildings. And as I was thinking back about this, I think one important moment was when I bought my first house. I was actually in graduate school, and in South Bend, they practically give away houses in certain neighborhoods of downtown, and for better and worse. And so it was actually cheaper for us to buy in some ways than to rent. And so we bought a 1915 bungalow designed by a well-known South Bend architect of that time. And small and modest in size, but really well designed and beautiful. And I kind of started paying attention to buildings when I moved into that house and started researching it. We had the blueprints, and I got interested in buildings for the first time. And I started, we made the pilgrimage to Chicago, to Oak Park, and visited Frank Lloyd Wright's house. And started doing architectural tours of Chicago and learning about all of that. And I just started paying attention to buildings. I would say when I started doing my research in Central America, I also started paying more attention to religious buildings. And that then continued when I would say from a personal level, when I moved to Vermont, I started attending an Episcopal cathedral, St. Paul Episcopal Cathedral, and it's a beautiful space, but very non-traditional. It's a brutalist structure, and the sound, I know Brian doesn't think much of brutalism in architecture, and I think generally speaking, there's a lot wrong with it, but this particular space was really well designed for its particular place, and it's just a beautiful place to pray and sing. And that also shaped, got me thinking more about how a building can shape how we experience, how people experience both community and transcendence in a particular place and time. And so that was part of the other impetus. And so Brian and I, at a conference, found ourselves on the same panel on... years after graduate school, a panel discussing religion and buildings, religious buildings. And after that panel, we went out to lunch and started talking and realized we both had these really interesting ideas and decided to write an article. And before long, we were sort of scheming about writing a book together.
Brian, I'm wondering, you have a particular interest, always have, I remember as long as we've known each other, in urban spaces and things. So how did that sort of connect with your desire to write this project as well?
Yeah, to some degree, it was this conversation we had. I went back and looked it up. November 2014 in Indianapolis at a Chipotle. After our panel, we went and had lunch, and Rob laid out all the ideas, right, and said, I have these ideas, I'm thinking about this. And I said, what about this, this, and this? And he graciously said, oh, maybe I should think about that. Maybe we could work a little bit with that. And that sort of jump-started the project. But I had had some background in doing some research on buildings previously. I had published a piece on McMansions, of all things, which I would not classify usually as sacred spaces, but there's another aspect of buildings. And going back since I was a kid, I've always loved spaces and buildings, visiting places, walking through them, thinking about them, how are they constructed? But I had not found maybe all the ways to put that together academically or in scholarly work. So this idea sounded great to me here in November 2014, and now it seems like it was a long time ago, but it was, I thought, a very fruitful process. We had an article that came out a few years after that in Sociology of Religion that ended up being, I guess it's chapter two in the book, or chapter one or chapter two. It's the one after the introduction, and I can't remember if they're numbered, yeah, whatever. But it's in there, right, and we reworked it and then built on that, right, added layers to it to get to the book.
I know everybody on the podcast is a person of faith, and there's an expression that people use often in the evangelical church. We often say, you know, I was raised in the church. We don't usually literally mean that we lived in church. If you would have mailed us something, it would have arrived at the church and we would have walked out in our pajamas. However, I can make probably a bigger claim than some to being raised in my church because my mom was a church administrative assistant, and I spent like age 0 to 5, I was like in the church. It was the place that I played. It was the place that I ran around, like built Legos and spent tons of time there. And we went to church 3 or 4 times a week as well. So I definitely formed a relationship, and it was right behind my house. I could walk there. I could throw a rock and hit it from my house. So I'm curious to hear from you, Rob, what your relationship to religious buildings has kind of been across your life, and maybe how that relationship has changed, if it has in any way.
Yeah, well, in the introduction, I talk a little bit about growing up a pastor's kid and actually a pastor's grandkid. My grandfather really helped start the church, took a Methodist country church building and turned it into a Mennonite church, and transformed it almost, not quite single-handedly, but put a lot of his own resources into updating it towards being what I would consider a kind of living room church, a comfortable space, one in which rural southern Michigan families could feel at home and could spend a lot of time. So I, a little like you, David, I spent a lot of time in that building, running around, playing games, waiting through very long elders meetings of all kinds. And we just hung out in that space a lot. And that is a very, I've discovered since sojourning for 10 years with an Episcopal congregation, that it's very different approach to its building, whereas this low church Mennonite, basically evangelical in most senses, congregation wanted its building to be a comfortable space where anyone could, where we could feel community. At St. Paul's, I discovered a different approach to a building where the building is intended to evoke reverence and awe. And it doesn't have to be comfortable. Maybe it even shouldn't. And I just 2 days ago had my 12-year-old son came to me and said, "It's funny, Dad, how so many Mennonite churches have carpet in the sanctuary. That's so weird." And I grew up, that was normal because the sanctuary was supposed to feel comfortable. And he's been attending services at an Episcopal cathedral for the past 10 years, and there's no carpet in that place, at least not in the worship spaces, and it's not intended to be comforting, communal. It is supposed to sort of be a space where you are impressed with the grandeur of God. So that's kind of a shift, and I wouldn't say that I have a preference for one or the other, but as a sociologist, I've come to realize there are very different ways that congregations approach building a space to gather for worship.
Speaking of carpet, the church I was in when I was growing up and running around the church and hanging out there actually split in part over the color of carpet during a renovation. There's a little matter of like a method of baptism too, but the carpet was what sort of came up a lot. So yes, probably quite different approaches from somebody arguing over the color of the carpet, and not having carpet at all wouldn't be a thought, like take the carpet out. Very interesting. Brian, talk about some of your relationship to religious buildings across your life and how, if it's changed at all, kind of how you've seen that change.
A lot of time in church growing up with Sunday mornings, other activities. But if I look back, I think a lot of it changed in high school when I started playing in music groups, either for youth group or on Sunday morning. And you're in the church building at different hours, right? Which changes your focus from, you know, here's something going on, there's a service, it's planned, to, hey, people can just wander through this church building at all hours of the day. It is literally a normal building when there's not all these people here. And doing more of that, and then college, and then similarly, started attending an Episcopal church in graduate school, one that was about a mile away from our offices there in sociology on the Notre Dame campus. And I would add not just the reverence and awe, but I would say a bigger theology of material things than I was used to in my non-denominational Christian world, just seeing objects as being part of worship and rituals more than the more spiritual emphasis that I knew growing up, where it was kind of all in your head and your emotions and interacting personally with God. Now it included the whole room, involved sitting and standing, what was on the walls mattered. It went from being plain to being very thought out and purposeful in a different way.
It's so interesting. We're going through, obviously, there's a little bit of a pandemic going on right now. If people aren't familiar, if anybody listens to this in the future, it'll probably still be remembered. So our church, which is very large, Brooke and I go to the same non-denominational church here in the area, and we usually have like 2,000 people per service on the weekends. So we are meeting online and plan to through the end of the year, and they're overhauling the sanctuary during this time. And I got to preview it the other day, and my jaw dropped because they took out all the windows. All the natural light is gone because now the building is not even so much for the people in the room, but for the people beyond it. So, you know, going on and going forward, it's going to be more about lighting and production. And it's not a slick and glitzy way necessarily, but I thought it was so interesting. And I know we have pastors on staff who are really upset that the one, you know, it looks like a warehouse already. This was like the one sort of like human warm touch we had, but the blinds were always closed anyway because it's really hard to light for anybody on stage. But at least they were there, but now they are no longer there. And we're actually viewing as the building is actually about going beyond the walls, and it's going to become even less important about the we that are gathered in the room. And that feels like a weird shift to me, I have to say. You guys, the book is a lot about the we and the communal feel and community that churches can gather in the relationship between buildings. And as I kind of understand it simply, how buildings sort of create communities and how communities create buildings in that reciprocal relationship. And I saw this quote, and I'm thinking about now, this seems very prescient for this book to come out now, where a lot of people are like really ambivalent about going back to church buildings. And I think a lot of people are feeling out of community as a result. And we're not sure exactly what church will look like when all of this COVID-19 stuff is over. You have a quote from your prologue. It says, talking about church buildings, it says, buildings have a tendency to do this, to build a we out of a collection of individuals. But this e pluribus unum function can be easy to forget until the physical structure is jeopardized. So I'm curious, I'll start with you, Brian, just this idea. Well, what do you feel is happening to that we of religious communities as a lot of their buildings sit empty or are partially attended or are suppressed to like groups of 30 in a larger church? What do you think is kind of happening to that we right now during this time?
That's a great question. And I suppose we'll wait and see what happens. I think we would argue, and the book talks about this a lot, churches miss something, communities miss something when they're not in a physical space together. Doing church online is a different, qualitatively different experience than being in the same room, not just because there's people, but because the building is pushing you and shaping you in particular ways. I've been speculating with some colleagues here on campus and the theology department, some other departments, what will happen after COVID-19? We don't know, right? Will people return? Will there be a hunger for going back to these buildings and returning to them? Or will people just say, hey, online church worked. I didn't have to get up and get ready to church and go there. And they have good production values. Look, it looks great. It's like watching TV. Hard to know.
Rob, what has been your experience of, I'm not sure where you are in your transition either. Clearly, you were part of a church in Vermont, sounds like for a long time, and you've relocated. I'm guessing you relocated during this time. So what has that been like for you to feel like you're part of a church community during this time?
Two things. One, I don't think Episcopal high church liturgy translates very well on Zoom. We tried it when we were in Vermont, and it was not very satisfying. And I would say that as a compliment to Episcopalian Episcopal worship. It's very embodied, and it's supposed to be. And when you take out that element, you lose a lot. And there's a lot of movement in an Episcopal worship service. And I came to appreciate that. And we tried one Zoom. We couldn't even get all the way through one Zoom church service. It just wasn't working for us. Definitely not working for our kids either. So we took a hiatus. And now that we live in Goshen, we keep getting invited to Zoom church for a lot of different churches. And I'm not interested. I just can't. Zoom church doesn't do it for me. I have a feeling a lot of other people are like that. But it is a little bit like school. It is better than nothing for a lot of people as well, especially if you've already built a sense of community and camaraderie and trust. And so I think it is a decent stand-in, but it's not the same. One of the arguments that we make in the book is that, borrowing from Randall Collins's research on interaction ritual chains, he has this interesting piece where he writes about the phalanx as a military innovation that's actually really just a social innovation. And it's based on the recognition that when people are physically very close to each other, they are less likely to desert. They're less likely to leave. And in a battle, on the battlefield, I know it's weird for a pacifist to be making this argument, but on the battlefield, when you have a tight knot of people, of human bodies close together, facing a potential danger and even imminent death, tight physical proximity and barriers to outsiders in terms of very clear demarcation of who's with us and who's not, you reduce the odds of desertion. You reduce the number of people who desert. And so I think one argument that we make in the book is that Pentecostalism, to a certain degree, innovated in bringing bodies closer together and closer to the action on at the front. And in many cases, this seems to have benefited them by making them feel like a closer knot of people with more physical co-proximity, making it easier to share mood and be mutually entrained. And all those things are elements of a successful interaction ritual, which means people are more likely to keep coming back and more likely to identify themselves with the group that meets there. All that to say, David, physically, not being physically present really does pose a threat to the sense of a community in a congregation. Essentially, a congregation that isn't congregating physically has lost something. And not saying it's going to dissolve overnight, or that when it's allowed to congregate again, it won't recongregate. But I have a feeling that this is not doing a lot of good for social capital in religious communities of all kinds.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think we've all seen the news, and we see sort of the sort of mask, anti-mask sort of obsession on either side, trampling on rights versus, you know, don't be a jerk and, you know, hole up in your house. You know, so Kara and I, my wife and I, are somewhere in the middle on that. But I see public spaces like our malls here. Like, there's an outdoor mall, huge one in our area, and it is packed. Like, there is something about people getting out and being around each other, sort of under whatever guise, that I think makes us feel normal. But I wonder how going to church in a physical space may be replaced. I think it's also really interesting, Rob, what you said about, I think the church that Brooke and I go to, that model of doing church and that the liturgy is much more portable, right? It's meant to sort of, like, we literally have churches that you can pack up in a trailer and then set up in a room. This is a very popular model. You don't find that much as much in like Catholic and Episcopal churches and sort of higher liturgy churches. And I wonder if there is some sort of differential impact to the bonds that form and how they're sustained across this time. But I know, Brooke, Brian, do you have something to say on that?
Yeah, one of the things I think we do nicely in this book is we include a lot of religious traditions that, just as you said, you know, we might often think that the sort of low church, non-denominational model, it can be packed up, it can be moved around, they meet in schools, they take it online. And yet even those groups that we looked at were very interested in their physical settings and their buildings, right? It mattered when they set things up how exactly it was arranged. Even though it might have been in a leased school, they still wanted it a particular way. They dreamed about a future. They had a way that they wanted that to shape the people's experiences. Even if it wasn't this sort of high church liturgical embodied tradition, the building still mattered, right? And we were consistently impressed by that across religious groups. And we've got a range of Christian and non-Christian groups who pay attention to that.
That's really cool. Our church is super activistic. So in some ways, super evangelical in expected ways, but we actually have a community center that functions as that. It's not like a church country club, but we have all kinds of people that don't claim any sort of faith come in and receive help with, you know, English as a second language and computer skills, free medical and dental clinics. So for us to shut our building down, one thing that was interesting when I started going to the church where we go now, it's a Vineyard church. It's the largest vineyard in the movement, I think. And Brooke's been going there a long time too, is that the church was always busy. My church growing up was like, it was shut and dark 98% of the week. And that's not true here. You know, maybe from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., there's no one there. But pretty much all other times, somebody's in the building for doing something. And we have a high value on using that the building still. So we've basically turned ours into like resource allocation centers. So we basically, if you go into our lobby, there's like diapers and food stacked to the ceiling. We do distributions of cleaning supplies and food. So we're linked into larger networks of social assistance. And now this is a lot of what our pastors do, is like provide relief. And we're trying to work on some educative functions to help offset some of the educational gaps for kids who don't have access to good education during this time. It's really, really interesting. So the building, even in our church, is really important. Brooke, we've talked a little bit about what has your experience been of being away from the building? Because, Brooke, you came back from a sort of a lot smaller church in the Netherlands where you were for over 10 years, mm-hmm. and then had the whiplash of going back to this huge American mega church with thousands of people that can feel really impersonal, mm-hmm. and now back to like Zoom and not going to a building at all. So I'm wondering kind of how you're feeling in this transition as well, especially as the pandemic has gone on.
Yeah, it's been very discombobulating as well. And I think I was reflecting on this regarding your book, because the church where I pastored in the Netherlands, it was a non-denominational sort of church, a Vineyard church, but we were in a building, an old Protestant church, that the last time a present congregation had been there was 1926. So it was super interesting to be a congregation and enter this building that had sat empty for a really long time. Well, not empty as many churches in Europe, but had been a museum, had been a civic center, had been something like that, and then be a church in it. Yeah, and coming back here was really odd. But I was reflecting even, and I'm curious about this regarding your book, because my earliest memories, my formative experiences in church buildings is actually not, excuse me, in religious buildings. It's not church buildings. It was in mosques. So I was raised the first 10 years of my life in Fez, Morocco, which, if I'm getting this right, I think I remember this correctly, has the most mosques per square mile in anywhere in the world. Fez does. And so church was living room, but religious buildings were mosques. And there was this interest and attraction and beauty to these spaces that were open all the time, that you could enter at different moments for people who were unbelievers, or different spaces of them, but was a part of sort of my earliest memories of religious spaces. So I think that's also kind of very much informed how I feel about religious spaces. There is a looseness to where they can be and what they look like based on that upbringing, I think.
You make an important point that religious structures or religious buildings serve different purposes and are intended to serve different purposes. And hearing from both of you, David and Brooke, we're getting a sense of the way congregations want different things from their buildings. And so you're talking about a non-denominational church that has lots of ministries that bring people at all times of day. That's generally good for a community when people are coming and going. To go back to Jane Jacobs, it puts more eyes on the street, and some communities really need that. All communities need that at some level, but it plays a very important function in some communities. And but it's not just a church that has lots of social services. Also, traditional denominations, high church denominations like Catholic and less so Episcopal, want their doors open. It's very important for the church to be open all hours of day so that people can come and pray, because the church is intended to be a place of worship even when it's not holding formal services, so that people can come and pray in a chapel, seek confession, and that brings people coming and going at different times of the day as well, and that can be an important, but again, it's a very different purpose, even social purpose, for that church, and it's important to recognize that congregations serve these different purposes and bring people together in ways that aren't just for congregational worship. And one more thing that I would add is that we have an interesting chapter that sort of profiles three different architects of religious buildings, two of whom are at very different places on what a church building should do because of their very different religious upbringing. I have a Catholic architect and a Mennonite architect, both of whom have done multiple religious buildings in the course of their careers, and they couldn't be any more different in what they think a religious building, a church building, should do. One thinks that the church building should essentially serve the function of providing a good gathering space. It should be kind of like a blank slate for whatever that congregation needs. And the other, obviously the Catholic professor of architecture at Notre Dame School of Architecture, he believes very strongly that even when a church is empty, it should speak. It should communicate to anyone who passes by there. It should point, almost like an icon. It should point to God and point to the Christian tradition, and it should be recognizable. And so it should speak a vernacular. People should be able to understand what it is, the sort of language of transcendence that it speaks, even when no one is in it. And those are very different views, and we don't take any position on which one is right, but it's worth understanding that congregations and religious traditions have these very different approaches to what a religious building should do.
It's so interesting. Brian, what do you think on that?
Yeah, and I would note in that chapter, too, one of the takeaways I had from the interviews that Bob did with those architects, that even within those religious traditions, there are very lively debates about what those buildings should be. So it's not a monolithic Catholic approach to buildings. So this Notre Dame professor is reacting to more modernist tendencies in the Catholic Church over the last 50 years or so, and wants to bring it back to something he thought the church lost. And there's not agreement in this worldwide body of Catholics. And there's even some disagreement among Mennonites as well, as the other architect Bob was mentioning brings out, right? Some want a more plain building, some want more aesthetic value, right? And it depends on the congregation and the context. And then the architects helps sort that out, gives them a vision.
And some have windows and natural light, and others do not.
It's so interesting. It's kind of bringing me to another topic that has come up to me a lot with church buildings lately. But I may have even been I heard of this. Oh God, I hope it wasn't in your book, because I sometimes forget where I remember things from. But just the idea, I think I had read about a church, like I think it was maybe a Catholic church, had sold a building to a Spanish speaking church community, and they had covered up all of the stained glass, like in its inner city, this beautiful church, and you know, former parishioners were just lamenting what was becoming of their building. But a lot of churches, communities are moving into buildings that probably don't fit the purposes they would sort of hold dear for an actual physical space. There's just such a premium on having a room. The lowest common denominator seems to be that everybody gets in a room and you do something together, right? Like there's a community thing where all the community can fit in the space, or most of it can. But then everything else about it is sort of weird and sort of up for debate and probably up for renovation if people could find real estate a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Curious, guys, to hear what you obviously, you talked about, you know, philosophy and intended purpose, and that's reflected in architecture. But one of the things I've been reading about more and more in the literature on gentrification and urban spaces is what people feel churches ought to do as landowners in that space. Sometimes buildings sit empty. They have quite a bit of property in areas where it's hard to come by, particularly where sometimes rents get escalated and people get driven out. So I've been reading some things about people really pushing for churches to build low-income housing, rental housing in areas, and maybe convert space or convert property for different purposes. I'm curious, what role do you think religious buildings and religious property can play, or should play, if you want to put down a little bit of an opinion, in fostering equality or inequality in surrounding communities?
I can tackle that. A few thoughts, specifically of church building or church groups using their buildings or property for the surrounding community. We don't go into that explicitly in this book, but I did some follow-up work after the book on some zoning issues in New York City. And what you find is a lot of this differs by religious tradition and the neighborhoods that they're in, right? Is there a need for the congregations to be providing something? If there is, many churches and certain traditions are willing to do that. But usually in more well-off communities, that's not as much of a need, right? And so the church building and property can sort of stay to itself or not have to meet some of those needs. One of the issues that comes up in our book, we've got zoning issues, right? A church, if you want to build a building or renovate an old building, you've got to go to local officials and make a pitch and sort of say whether it fits whether in local guidelines or not. And the community can say yes or no to that. I got into this maybe about 10 years ago now here in DuPage County because there were some cases of Muslim groups who wanted to build mosques and they were encountering opposition. And I wanted to know, is that true just for Muslim groups or is that true for all religious groups, right? If you wanted to build a large Christian church in the middle of a residential neighborhood, would you face opposition? And the answer in our book and some of the later work I've done is it's a little bit of both, right? Certain groups do get more opposition to their plans and their buildings. It tends to be Muslim groups tend to get more opposition due to their the political climate of the last few decades. 9/11, particularly in the New York area, led to a lot of issues. They're a newer group on the American religious scene. But other groups get opposition, too. So in New York City, it ends up being Orthodox Jews get a lot of pushback because they bring a church building and a lifestyle, right? There's a whole way of life that surrounds the church building, maybe even up to a half mile or mile where people can't drive on the Sabbath. They have to have stores that provide certain items. But we also found in the book that having a building for many religious groups is empowering, right? It's a foothold in a community. So if you're new to a community, you're a new group, new immigrant group, new religious group on the scene, finding a building and establishing yourself there, whether you're renting it, you're building it, you're renovating it, means something, right? That group finds it very powerful to establish themselves. I'm thinking of the Seventh-day Adventist church that Bob profiles in Guatemala, where, you know, they pooled so much of their resources to build a relatively small cement block structure. But to them, that was their world, right? This was meaningful. This was going to structure the rest of their lives and knit these families together and help out in the neighborhood. And that's true in many American settings as well. Getting that building or building that space, having that space, is a path towards equality, participation, and civic involvement.
That's really interesting, Brian. That also reminds me of what homeownership is. For a lot of people, you know, when you buy a home in a community, then it kind of gives you license to almost feel more able to get involved, more able to share an opinion, to attend a city council meeting. That's fascinating that church buildings do that too for communities.
It confers a legitimacy as well. I think I just started a small business and I remember those painful months where people are like, "Do you have a website yet?" And I'm like, no, like I don't feel official. And I've been a part of enough church plants where there is sort of a drive that is not just like an acquisitive drive, right? Like we just don't want to have property, but it's just like it gives us a sort of standing and like solidness and a reality to our affiliation. There's always that sort of drive for permanence and residence. Pretty cool. We're getting close to wrapping up here. These times always fly by. So put on your futurist hats here as guys that have looked at church buildings of different stripes and religious buildings of different stripes. I'm curious about how you see the role of religious buildings in the future. Will it change? Will it stay the same? And just any conjecture on what sort of congregations and their what kind of buildings that house those congregations will thrive as we go forward, you know, and you can sort of leave the pandemic out of it if that feels too squirrely.
Didn't bring my crystal ball with me in the move, but it didn't work anyway, so that shouldn't be a barrier. I was reminded when you asked this question of, I interviewed a mega church pastor in Guatemala City. He's the one where they built a really big auditorium that could house about 10,000 people. And then an earthquake and a landslide happened, and they had to abandon the structure after it was built. And so he actually came to believe that that was a good thing. And the congregation seemed to be embracing the fact that they weren't going to have this giant structure, that they were going to meet in about three different places around the city. One of which was a parking garage turned into a sanctuary, which was really interesting. And I went there once to experience it. He argued that the era of building large mega church building projects, large places that could house a lot of people at once, is over. And he was saying this as a mega church pastor of one of Guatemala's biggest projects. And that may not come as much of a surprise to somebody living in North America, but in Guatemala, where they've had about 5 or 6 different really large mega church buildings built in the last 2 decades, it was kind of going on out on a limb for him. But he says that going forward, you might see big churches of 1,000 or 2, but you're not likely to see really big churches building a big building to sort of say, here we are, and this is our place, and we want to gather as many people at once. He said, you know, you're going to see churches building more mid-sized sanctuaries. And I mean, obviously he was talking about the evangelical experience that he was a part of. But that's the one thing that comes to mind. In the United States, it seems like almost not saying much to say that we're not going to see gigantic, expensive cathedrals or church buildings anymore. The era of Riverside and the National Cathedral or the Basilica or something like that, that's over. That seems not risking much to say that. But elsewhere, it does seem like it was an interesting thing for this pastor to say.
I'll point to a few things. First, building off Rob's point, I'll point to 2 books that have been really formative for me in thinking on this. One by a geographer named Justin Wilford called Sacred Subdivisions, about Saddleback Community Church in Southern California, one of these big mega churches that he discovered as a geographer really has flipped the model in that there is a central campus, but the way that the church functions most of the time is through these small groups scattered all throughout the Los Angeles region, right? So there is the central building, but it's essentially not that meaningful, right? And people don't often go there. The church works sort of around it. So it's sort of outside in as opposed to the big building spreading out. And then there was a book a couple months ago, sociologists Mark Mulder and Gerardo Marti wrote, called The Glass Church, about Robert Schuller's church, the Crystal Cathedral. It's a fascinating case study where they essentially argue that all that capital and energy that has to go into constructing large buildings and keeping large congregations going eventually implodes, right? Keeping that all in the air and finding the money and working it just is going to not work, right? You're going to reach these points of complexity where the problems can't be solved. And they sort of detail in his case why it fell apart and why now that building is now owned by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange. And his congregation is sort of scattered in a couple different directions. I think from our book, though, too, we found that a number of church buildings get reused by other religious groups. And so on one hand, you will hear that a lot of church buildings are being converted to other uses, and there's a lot of people worried about that. I just got a book the other day in the mail from some historic preservationists who said, you know, this is bad, this is impoverishing our landscape, taking these sacred buildings and just throwing them on the open market. And yet, on the other hand, what we found in our data is that a lot of them get recycled into other religious groups, right? So if you're a new religious group or you're one of these dying religious groups, go there, right? Find another religious group that needs this, or the trend towards merging congregations now where you've got an older church with a building and a newer church that's up and coming that doesn't have that kind of space, put them together, right? Or find some way to share that space so it doesn't just disappear. I think we'll see a lot more of that, which particularly conservative Protestants have resisted because they want to be independent. But buildings are valuable commodities, and there's plenty of them out there that can be used for religious purposes.
I like that. Very hopeful.
It is. It's a hopeful note to end on. You guys did very well. Sociologists can often be rather dire, with all their negative statistics and things. That was a good, pretty pictures way to end things, Brian. Rob, nicely done.
Aww.
So thanks for being on today. The book is called Building Faith, A Sociology of Religious Structures. Guys, where can we find that book, and where can people follow you guys as well and check out some of your other writing?
You can get it on Amazon, or you can order it direct from Oxford University Press. So we'll probably make $1 extra if you buy it direct from Oxford University Press.
So I'll redact that Amazon part. No, just kidding. I won't.
Yeah.
I won't. But or just send them $1. Just directly. Just send them $1. It's good. Do you guys have any blogs or any new projects that you're working on?
Well, I have a blog that I somewhat irregularly publish on, post on. It's called homiesandhermanos.org. And that relates to my first book about Central American gang members leaving the gang and joining the church, joining churches of a variety of kinds. And so that's tended to be the theme that I go back to the most is religion and violence in Central America, especially youth violence. I'll leave it at that. So if you want to see any of the other work that I'm doing relating to gangs, that's kind of continues to be my bread and butter at Homies and Hermanos. Or you can just Google me and it will probably come up.
Awesome. Thanks, Rob. What about you, Brian?
I try to blog regularly at legallysociable.com, legallysociable.com. And a lot of the content there is about suburbs and suburban growth and development. So trying to work on some projects dealing with how cities are depicted on TV. Was working one recently about teardowns, what they look like before and after. So continuing some of this building theme, but moving it to single family homes and how that might affect communities and suburban neighborhoods.
Thank you guys so much for being on, and can't wait to get my physical copy of the book. I'm really excited to have it in my collection and recommend it to friends. So thanks, guys, so much.
Thank you, David and Brooke.
Thanks to both of you.
Life is not a sequence, but-